You're listening to episode 10 of season 9 of the GNU World Order. Hi everyone, this is Klaatu and this is the GNU World Order. This is a show about technology, about geeky things, about Unix and BSD, and lately programming, specifically in Python. As usual, I'm coming to you from New Zealand, or rather not as usual, but it's the new usual, that's what we're doing. I'm in New Zealand now, and it's a great place, it's really a lot of fun. If you ever have the chance to visit or move there for work or anything like that, you should jump at the chance, because it's really just an amazing, amazing place, and I haven't even gotten that far out of the city in which I live yet, although I will be doing that later, actually this evening, going to some kind of event where there are people playing with fire and things like that. From what I can tell on the maps, it looks like it's going to be out in the hills a little bit, so that should be a lot of fun. Gorgeous country, though. Really, really nice. And last episode, I talked a little bit about the difference in culture of coffee here in New Zealand. Speaking of which, I'm drinking coffee right now, and it is very, very good. And I'm actually, because I'm doing this podcast right now, I'm missing a big event in the city that is all about coffee. But it seemed a little bit commercial and just not necessarily something I absolutely had to go. But, I mean, there's a lot of coffee places. I didn't mean to suggest in the previous episode that there wasn't a healthy amount of coffee here. Wellington apparently is kind of famous for its coffee, and I would say justly so. Every chance I get to get coffee when I'm out and about, I take it, and I always enjoy it thoroughly. So, yes, very good coffee here. But the one thing that I kind of wanted to mention in this episode about New Zealand, just kind of comparing cultures and everything, is this whole metric versus imperial system of measurement, which I've become keenly aware of course, as having grown up primarily in the United States and pretty much exclusively in the USA, like the culture of it, even if it wasn't physically in the US. I'm kind of used to, or at least as used to as anyone in the USA is, to the imperial system of measurements. So we have inches and feet and yards and things like that. And one thing I've noticed since I've been here is that we were never really that firmly and solidly invested in the imperial system anyway in the USA. Have you ever noticed that? I mean, if you live in the USA, think about it. Like we talk in inches by default, but we all still use centimeters, and sometimes we use meters, and weird, you know, we have like this kind of hybrid of both systems, and we kind of default to whatever happens to be easiest in whatever context we're actually using, which I think is kind of silly. And upon further thought, I kind of realized that one of the biggest problems, I mean, the imperial system is, if you think about it, like it's based on quarters, right? On fourths. And if you think about basing something on fourths, it's not that far away from basing things on 8 or 16. And if you think at all, if you can think in hexadecimal, which a lot of computer users can, you know, thinking in hex and thinking in imperial is not that far off. They're very similar, at least in my mind. So I don't think imperial in itself is like a bad thing, and I kind of almost kind of like that it works in quarters of things. But I think the root of the problem is that the smallest possible measurement that you can speak of conveniently is an inch, which, I mean, when you're measuring small things, an inch is huge. I mean, that's just too much, and so you start talking in ridiculous fractions of things. You know, you're saying things like, oh yeah, this is 14/16 of an inch, or something ridiculous like that. I don't know why you would say that, actually, but, I mean, even so, 7/8 of an inch, or 6/8 of an inch. I mean, what does that even mean? You can't even picture that, really. You can't picture that on a ruler, and if you do try to, then the little lines on the ruler are so tiny, and the ink usually bleeds over so much that you're just looking at this weird sort of unsteady line across that inch. And so it becomes very difficult, and so your mind says, you know, what would be easier is just do this in centimeters because they're smaller, and then I could just say 2.5 centimeters or whatever. So I think the problem with the imperial system is not that it's incorrect inherently. I mean, you know, basing your system on sort of a hex breakdown of measurement, I think is fine. But you kind of need to give people something smaller to work with, and you also need to commit to it fully. I think part of the problem in the U.S. is that, again, we do kind of, there's this struggle, you know, we all use the imperial system because it's what we're taught, and so we do default to it, but I think everyone pretty much wants to switch over to metric, and so we switch to metric when we can, and then we switch back to imperial when it's too hard to think in metric, and so on. So that's my insight for from living in New Zealand, from living abroad. I hope you enjoyed it. I know I did. So let's get started on Python, because that certainly is much more apropos to the proclaimed subject of this Ogcast. Okay, so Python. Last time we started up Python and we got introduced to some APIs or some frameworks, I could say. Or I could even say modules or libraries. And Pygame, of course, is a set of libraries, or you could call it a framework, for doing little games, video games, in Python. And whether or not you intend to do games, I find it kind of fun and entertaining to work with Pygame, because you figure if you're going to be learning something, you might as well be learning it in the context of video games, because who doesn't like video games? Later in this series, I do want to touch on PyQt, which is a very, very powerful framework that essentially marries something simple like Python to something complex like Qt, which, of course, the entire KDE desktop and lots of famous applications like Skype and Maya and I can't really think of anything else off the top of my head. But there are obviously a lot of things out there written in with the Qt GUI set. And I particularly like Qt because of its cross-platformedness. And that goes really well, I think, with Python, which really kind of works, I think, really hard to be cross-platform as well. And Pygame does a really good job of that as well. So the most important thing to know about Pygame.org, I think, or Pygame, is pygame.org/docs. And the documentation on Pygame is some of the most clear documentation of any Python library set that I've ever really used myself. I mean, there may be other examples out there, but the fact that someone who just kind of taught themselves programming can go to pygame.org/docs and look things up, like pygame.display.git_surface --, and kind of understand how to use that, is a big deal. So it's a great introductory set of libraries, and you should definitely take a look at it, read over the things that interest you, and mess around with them in possibly an interactive shell, because a lot of times the interactive shell is actually the easiest way to get, I mean, it is the easiest way to get instant feedback. It gets a little bit tough once you start trying to make classes and things like that, functions, you know, because you're just typing in so many things, and then if something doesn't work, you have to sort of up arrow and retype them all in, so that doesn't really work that well once you start getting really complex. And unfortunately, that is what we're about to do, is get kind of a little bit more complex now. So you probably won't be doing today's exercise in an interactive Python session, but that's okay. So what we will do is look at this Feeding Frenzy game, which, again, if you go to straightedgelinux.com just go to straightedgelinux.com and then go to the weblog and then go into the Python section, and then you can find the programming book, which you may or may not have been using all this time, to follow along. And go down to chapter 11, which is the Pygame introduction, and it's kind of what we were starting to flirt with a little bit last episode, and then I ran out of time and had to do a really abbreviated version of it. So in this time we're going to kind of go through it step by step, line by line, and just really try to understand the logic of getting a really simple little game going. So let's start. So the first couple of lines you should really kind of already know. You should be able to anticipate it. It would be shebang/usr/bin/env(env) /Python. And once again, that is the line that tells your shell what to use when you invoke Python. There are different ways to do this, and there are better ways to do this, but for now that's what we're doing. We're just saying invoke env, which is going to tell us what default Python binary is appropriate for our system. So if we have both Python 2.6 and 2.7 and 3.0 installed, then env will know which version of Python is marked as our default. And it would be marked by, as our default, because it was first in our path. And that's in our environment, Python path. So that's why we use that. The next couple of lines would be the imports. And those are kind of common at this point too, right? You're kind of used to this. Obviously we would want to import Pygame. We would want to import sys, S-Y-S. That's kind of an important or a helpful one. And from pygame.locals import asterisk. So that's from pygame.locals space import space asterisk. That simply brings in, well, a bunch of the commonly used functions and modules from the Pygame libraries. And we are importing it. We're doing this as a from pygame.locals import asterisk, and this is a way that you can import things from a library, but you're not just importing the library itself, you're importing the namespace of the library. So for instance, if there is a, well, let's just say there's a foo function in Pygame or something. If you just said import Pygame, then you would always have to, whenever you wanted to invoke foo, you would have to do pygame.foo, because you have to tell it which foo you want to invoke. So it would be pygame.foo, because there could, in theory, be another foo somewhere. There could be a pyblender.foo, or a, I don't know, a pycute4.foo. So we would have to prepend it with pygame.whatever in order for Python to know which library we're actually trying to invoke. So when you say from Pygame import or from pygame.locals import everything, then you're bringing in the namespace, so you can simply say foo, and it's imported the Pygame dot sort of into your environment without needing to be told which framework something belongs to. And there's a lot of things you can do with that. You can actually import different things as you can give them aliases within your script. So if you wanted to import Pygame as, you know, just the letter P or something, and then you would never have to spell out Pygame. I don't care to do that much myself, because I think that starts to get confusing. But I imagine if you're doing this every day for your job, which actually, interestingly, that's kind of starting to be the case for me, but I imagine at some point you could start using shortcuts like that, but for now we're going to just keep it simple. All right, so the next thing we can do here, and we don't necessarily have to do it right now, but I like to do this early and kind of get it out of the way. This is a Pygame thing. This isn't something that you're necessarily going to find in other frameworks, but one thing that we do have to do is initialize the Pygame environment, as it were. So pygame.init paren paren. So that just kind of tells our script to start up Pygame, start that module running in our script, as it were. That's just a Pygame thing. You don't have to do that with every module that you ever use by any means. In fact, I've actually never seen it in any other module, but I haven't really used like that many modules in my life, so it could be something that's a little bit common here, a little bit not common there. Okay, so the next line we're going to say clock equals pygame.time.clock with a capital C, paren, and what that does is it starts a pygame clock running in order to keep everything, I would say synchronized, but I don't think it's exactly synchronization that we're getting. It's pacing, I guess, would be a good way to do that. So with pygame.time, and you could, of course, go to pygame.org/docs and read up about pygame.time, but you will see that pygame.time.clock with a capital C is a class, and it creates an object to help track time. The reason, I mean, obviously, Python and Pygame and SDL and everything that you're using to start up your little video game, it can track time on its own. That's something that computers do fairly well. But to be honest, computers tend to go very quickly. That's what they attempt to do. And so with a game, we don't want really everything to happen within milliseconds. A lot of times we want things to get to a point and then slow down and stop and wait for the user's input. Or when someone starts running, you don't want them to get all the way across the screen just like that. You want them to have to get, you want the player to have to run someplace. So we want a little bit of pacing here, and that's what this clock is going to give us, especially when we start animating things, which we're not going to do today, but eventually we will. And so for that reason, we'll also establish a frames per second, and that's just going to be a variable, so we'll just say FPS equals 15. And again, you don't technically have to establish a variable here. You could just tell the clock to run at 15 frames per second. I just like to, as I think I said in the previous episode, I like to do a lot of variables, because that way when you go back in to change things, you don't have to hunt through your code for, okay, well, where did I put that, you know, where did I actually use the frames per second number? You can simply use frame per second as the variable throughout your script and change it once in your variable section, and it ripples through the rest of your script because now the variable means something different. So I do that frequently. And it was something that I really had to kind of force myself to do. It was something that I used to forget to do a lot. And then inevitably I would be going back through my scripts trying to find this or that value and realizing if I just established a variable for it in the first place, I could have stuck it into one section of my script, changed it as needed, and it would have rippled through the script naturally. Okay, so next variable set that we're going to create are the colors. And there's a little bit of flexibility here, but I'm going to establish some simple ones. Black equals paren 26 comma 26 comma 26 close paren, and if you know your RGB values, you know that that's not solid black, it's like 80% gray, but that's trendy now to use those sort of soft earth tony shades. Blue is going to equal paren 57 comma 103 comma 189 paren, and then I'm going to create a key color, like a chroma key. Key equals paren 0, comma 0, comma 255, close paren. So if you know your RGB values or even the logic behind it, you'll know that that means 0 red, 0 green, and all of the blue. So that's a very, very audacious kind of gaudy blue that we can use as our blue screen. And then score equals 0. And I don't even know if I'm using score in this game. I don't remember. But that's always a handy variable to have, and it's, if you're doing video games, you may as well get into the habit of establishing and sort of resetting your score at the very beginning of your game, or otherwise, you know, every time you play your game, it'll be compounding its score, and you won't remember why or understand why. Okay, so for all of these colors, of course, they're just using RGB, so 0, 0, 0 is the lowest, and then I'm thinking in hex. 255, 255, 255 would be all of the colors together. So you can use that to create color values that you can then reuse later on. There are lots of different ways to find out these RGB strings. You could use K-Color Chooser, which is in the KDE desktop, I think by default. You could, of course, open GIMP or Inkscape and use their color pickers. Or you can even find a Firefox add-on called ColorZilla, which gives you a little color picker in Firefox. So all of those are pretty good. I typically use K-Color Chooser because it's system-wide and you can pretty much click anywhere on your screen from any program and get the values in RGB, hex, and lots of other ways. So that's pretty handy. But yeah, there's lots of different ways to get RGB values. Not a big deal. Okay, so the next thing that we're going to do is create a new class, our first class of this game, and it's going to be our avatar class, the class that gives us a little character on screen, which, you know, generally are called avatars, or sprites. And I'm not calling this a sprite class because Pygame already reserves the name sprite. So sprite is a whole class in Pygame. If you look on pygame.org/docs and go up to the sprite section, you will see that there are sprite functions all over the place in Python, in Pygame rather, and they're very, very handy. This is saving us a lot of trouble. Imagine having to, you know, animate, paint pixels onto SDL manually. That just wouldn't be that fun. Whereas Pygame handles all that stuff for you. It's going to make importing graphics and even animating characters, if you have, you know, 4 graphics or 8 graphics that you can loop through to show your little character walking around, which we'll get to later in this series, I'm sure. It makes all that very, very simple. So we're going to invoke the Sprite class, and we're going to invoke specifically pygame.sprite.sprite with a capital S. And that's a simple base class for visible game objects. So in other words, if you want to create a visible object in Pygame, the place you want to start with is pygame.sprite.sprite. And it gives you a little example here on pygame.org/docs, and it's very handy. So let's create one, and I'll try to explain why we're creating it the way that we're creating it. So if you do a, I'm going to put a comment in here, create a sprite, and then I'm going to do the next line and say class space avatar paren pygame.sprite.sprite with a capital S, close paren, and then colon. And then the next line, of course, will indent. And that'll be def, D-E-F, space, underscore, underscore, init, underscore, underscore, paren, self, comma, file name, paren, colon. And then we'll do a return again and do a tab, tab, pygame.sprite.sprite with a capital S, dot, underscore, underscore, init, underscore, underscore, paren, self, paren. Next line, still tabbed over, so 2 tabs again. Self.image equals pygame.image.load, paren file name, close paren, dot, convert paren, paren. And then the next line, tab, tab, self.image dot set. Underscore color key, paren, keyer, close paren. Actually, key, sorry. Paren. Tab, tab, self.rect equals self.image.get underscore rect paren, paren. Okay, so that's a bunch of weird cryptic stuff, and I'm going to explain to you exactly what we've done and the logic involved. So the first line is should be pretty obvious, right? We're saying class space avatar. That's establishing a new class, and we're calling it avatar. And of course, we've invented the term avatar. We could have called it penguins. We could call it shoe. We could call it anything we want. It doesn't matter. But I'm calling it an avatar because that makes sense. So class space avatar, and then we say paren. Well, let's just say paren paren colon right now. Okay. So of course, when you're creating a class, the reason you put the paren paren after it is it's telling the program language, Python in this case, what exactly we want the class avatar to use and to call when it is being implemented. So in this case, we're saying class avatar, but what is this a class of? What are we using? Well, we're using the pygame.sprite.sprite library, and that's how we're creating this class avatar. It is invoking the pygame.sprite.sprite set of commands whenever we invoke class avatar. So avatar is essentially an instance of pygame.sprite.sprite, if you want to think of it that way. So the next line is, of course, tabbed once, and then we have def. So right away that means, okay, well, this is a function of avatar. And the first function and the only function of avatar that we have is a underscore underscore init underscore underscore parent self comma file name parent colon. So that means that we've got a function, and this is the initialization function of that of avatar. So when we call avatar later on in our program, whenever we call it, this init function is going to be run. It's always going to be run. Whenever you create a new avatar using this class, this init function is going to be run. Does that make sense? I think it probably does. Because just like in our Python dice game, where we're creating a dice object and we're telling it, okay, you have 21 sides or you have 6 sides or whatever, every single time that we ran that class, we're essentially creating a new die, yeah? And every time that we create a new die, we're able to tell it how many sides it has. So that's just information it needs in order to sort of to complete its little routine of, okay, I'm going to make a little, I'm going to make a die right now with X number of sides. We give it X. So in this case, every time we call avatar, it's going to create an avatar for us. But the information that it needs is a file name, which of course will be the graphic that it uses to represent itself on screen. And of course it needs the information about what kind of object it is. So the next line is tab tab pygame.sprite.sprite dot underscore underscore init underscore and underscore parent self parent. Okay, so this is a little bit of a confusing one, I think, because it is very self-referential, and it's a little bit related to something called super, which we might encounter later on. I think we will later in this series, but for now we'll keep it specific to Pygame. So it's stating that it's going to use pygame.sprite.sprite in order to initialize an instance of avatar. So it's necessarily vague. It doesn't know how it's going to do this or what kind of sprite it's going to spawn. It's just stating that it is going to create, it's going to use the pygame.sprite.sprite function in order to create or to initialize an instance of some sprite. And it doesn't know what sprite it is yet. So this whole the whole top three lines of this sort of code block that we've just done is indeed the three lines that we're about to cover, they're all initialization sequences. So if you think of when you boot up your computer on Linux, you're obviously running through these init processes, or I don't know what, maybe you're using systemd or whatever, it doesn't matter. Point is it's running through things that it needs to do early on in the process, and then once those are done, it can move on with its life. And that's kind of what's happening here. It's looking at the class that we're creating, and it's saying, okay, in this function, the init function, we're going to draw in the instance that we're talking about now, and we're going to get from the user, or from the programmer rather, a file name that we're going to use, you know, to visually represent the thing. And then we're going to call upon the pygames.sprite.sprite in order to initialize a sprite. We still don't know what sprite it is, but it's going to be a sprite. So that's what's going on here in this code block. The next line self.image equals pygame.image.load parent file name close parent.convert parent is kind of cool, because this is where you see sort of the flow of information in a class and a function, because we created the class avatar and we told it to bring in the pygame.sprite.sprite class, and then we told it, when you're initializing, whenever I tell you to create a new avatar, so that's the def underscore underscore init underscore underscore parent self, comma file name parent. Whenever we are initializing a new instance of this of an avatar, take as an argument the current instance of it, the self instance, and a file name. So now it's got access to this file name, which, you know, we haven't even yet given it in real life, but we know we will give it a file name. So it's got access to this file name, and it just kind of holds it in memory. And then we're saying, okay, and by the way, use pygame.sprite.sprite in order to create this thing. And then the next line here, we're saying self.image equals pygame.image.load, and then we say the file name. So we've passed that file name into the class, into the init function, and then we're actually utilizing it here, where we're assigning an image to our sprite. And we assign images to sprites, to objects, in Pygame with the pygame.image class. So if you look at in pygame.org/docs, you'll see that there's an image category. It's called pygame.image. And it tells you, here's what you can do with pygame.image. It says pygame module for image transfer. pygame.image.load is loading a new image from a file. pygame.image.save will save the image to a disk. pygame.image.get_extended will test if the extended image formats can be loaded, and blah blah blah, all these other functions that we don't care about right now. Point being, pygame.image.load is the way that you bring in an image from your file system into your Pygame world and put it somewhere. And in this case, we want to put it wherever our sprite appears. So, again, just because of the way that Python works and programming works in general, you don't just issue pygame.image.load as its own thing. You have to assign it to some place in memory, right? So that's why we use variables. So you've got a self.image equals, and then this crazy command, pygame.image.load parent file name close parent dot convert parent. And that's a little bit complex, but you can kind of see where it comes from. And we're converting it because we have to convert the image format to something that Pygame can use. And I'm trying to see if they actually have an example of that or not. If we say pygame.image.load, doesn't really have an example of that in their docs, unfortunately. So I like to tell you how you would have gotten there on your own, but I don't actually know how you would have gotten there on your own. But you would have figured it out, trust me. So there you go. The next line is self.image.set_color_key and then parent key. So this is simply saying that, hey, if we've got an image, then set the key, the color to set as our alpha channel, essentially. That's what a key is, right? It's looking at any predefined color and saying, okay, that's going to be so, that's, I'm going to display that as invisible. And we're saying if we've got an image, self.image dot set underscore color key to whatever value our key is. And that's, again, why we established those variables at the very beginning, so that we could say we want to use this color key value, but we don't want to have to type out the whole RGB string and then go change it if we change our mind, that we, instead of a blue screen, we want a green screen. So we're just using the word key here. So self.image.set_color_key parent key parent. And here we're modifying the image. So we're not creating a new variable. We're not making something new. We're actually modifying something that we currently have in memory. And that's why we're not doing any kind of variable setup there. And then the next line, we do create a new variable because we need to know the size and the shape of our sprite, and that is done with the self.rect equals self.image.get_rect --. So the function to sort of get shapes and sizes of on-screen objects in Pygame is done with this rect function, where you can look at the size and shape and sort of, you know, where on the screen something is, the position of something, through this basically rectangular coordinate system. And again, in the docs, you can see that in the rect, R-E-C-T section, you can find it. So essentially, it's a bounding box. That's what you can think of it as, because that's what it does. It looks at the shape of the image, and, you know, it takes the farthest corners of where that image space kind of occupies, and it returns those coordinates for you. So it's not the most precise way of calculating a position, because if you've got a circle, then, you know, if you're doing collision detection or something, you say, okay, we'll get the position of this circle, it's going to give you four corners. There are no corners in circles, so obviously it's not exact. But for this game, it doesn't really matter, so we are not going to really worry about that. So that's the theory and process of what we've done here. I hope that has made some kind of sense. It makes more sense, obviously, the more you do it, but that's not really what I want to leave you with. But yeah, so class avatar pygame.sprite.sprite. That's the thing where we are telling Pygame, draw something on the screen for me and track it, keep track of it as a sprite, make the position of that sprite on the screen available to me at all times, and make sure that anything that is solid, true blue, 00255 RGB, make that invisible. So that's hopefully somewhat helpful and somewhat sort of obvious to you. And then the next couple of lines that we can do is really just the same old stuff, I mean, that we did last week. It's window underscore width equals 960. Or whatever you prefer, whatever you think your screen can handle. Window underscore height equals 720. So we're doing a 720p sized window game window, and then we'll do a window underscore area, because that's actually what Pygame wants to hear. So we'll say window underscore area equals Pygame dot display dot set underscore mode paren square bracket window underscore width comma window underscore height close square brackets close paren. So we're creating a window area space, or I guess we could have just called it Pygame window or something, but or game window, whatever world. But we're creating a variable. We're calling it window underscore area, and we're saying it's going to be equal to the Pygame function Pygame dot display. And the arguments that the display is going to need to instantiate itself is a set underscore mode, in which we give it the width and the height of the desired space, which we've done. And then, of course, just to get fancy, we can, without creating a variable, we can take that display that we've created, and we can say, okay, take that display and set the caption to something. So we'll say pygame.display.set underscore caption paren quote feeding frenzy close quote close paren. Now if you wanted to be, I don't know, ridiculous, you could have, just to kind of keep reminding you of this, you could create a variable that would contain the window caption, right? You could say, like, you know, caption string equals quote feeding space frenzy close quote, and then later on when you actually want to set the caption, you could say pygame.display.set underscore caption paren caption string close paren, so there were no quotes in there. So you could do that, but for something like that, I don't really bother doing the variables with, but I'm just trying to kind of remind you of the different ways that you can manipulate information in Python. Okay, so now it gets a little bit more complex, and before we get started with the rest of this, we should probably take a coffee break, because let's face it, It's been, it's been nearly half an hour without any coffee, and that's never a good thing. So let's take a coffee break, and then we'll come back and finish this thing up. Well, here in Wellington, as I've said, coffee is a big deal, so I'm having a great cup of coffee right now. I'm hoping wherever you are, you can find yourself an equally good cup of coffee. So start drinking and enjoy it for a bit, and then let's get back to work. Alright, so hopefully you haven't actually finished your coffee, but you've gotten a good head start, because you're going to want coffee for the next part of this. This gets a little bit complex, but I think you can handle it, and that's why we're just going to keep going with it. So far we've created our hero, we've created sprites, one of which will be our hero. And we have also done things, and we've also created our world, which has involved things like setting our window area, essentially, and setting a caption and stuff like that. So that's our game world that has now instantiated. So at this point, what we need to do is manage spawning. So if you're a video gamer, which, as you know, I'm not really, but I like to pretend like I am. So if you're a video gamer, you know the concept of spawning, right? When your character appears on screen, that's called, a spawn point, or, you spawn a character. When bad guys start flocking around, they spawn usually before you're aware of it, and then you kill them all, and you continue through the game. Now, what happens if you go back, down another path in your game world? Well, the bad guys have respawned, and there's, like, a new group of bad guys in the place that they will all kind of hang out. That's usually how it works, because otherwise video game worlds would get very, very, very empty and very boring. So, spawning is something that happens in video games, and it's something that we have to manage as programmers. The code block most relevant to this would be all_sprites_list. So that's a variable that we're creating, and it's going to contain all of our sprites. It's going to be a list of all of our sprites. And we're going to set that to be equal to pygame.sprite.group with a capital G, paren paren. Now, pygame.sprite.group, as you can imagine, is a pygame class. You can probably also guess that I'm going to refer you to pygame.org/docs to find out more about it, but I'm not going to just let you find out about it on your own. I'm going to, of course, tell you that it is a container class to hold and manage multiple sprite objects. So pygame knows that usually in video games there's multiple instances of sprites. It's not something that you don't normally just have one or two sprites. You have groups of sprites. So it gives you this pygame sprite group. In order to use that class, of course, we have to create a variable and set it to being that class. So we're going to say, okay, all_sprites_list is equal to a pygame.sprite.group. Next, we'll say there's a food_list. And sure enough, we're going to set that to the same thing, pygame.sprite.group. So we're using this group tool that Pygame gives us to create two instances of it, all sprites list and food list, and then we're going to create, we're going to spawn our hero sprite. Now, in order to spawn our hero, we're calling upon a class, right? And this class is the one that we've created ourselves, called Avatar. So we're going to say player equals Avatar, and then paren paren, and try to remember what we said that our avatar class needs whenever we invoke it. If you'll recall, I said that it needs, it needs pygame.sprite.sprite, but that's already taken care of in the class itself, right? We said in the init sequence, we said pygame.sprite.sprite.init_paren_self_paren. So that it knows that it needs an instance of pygame.sprite.sprite, but it needed something else, and that is, of course, a file name. And the file name would be the file name of some graphic in an approved format. So a .png would be good because it can actually handle its own alpha layers, or you could do a .gif or a .bmp or a .jpeg or whatever. I'm going to use PNG. I'm going to point it to a penguin PNG. And for simplicity's sake, I'm going to put the penguin PNG in the same directory that I have the script that I'm writing right now. So we'll do in that paren, we'll do a quote, penguin.png, close quote. So the full line would be player equals avatar, paren, quote, penguin.png, close quote, close paren. So now it knows to grab the penguin.png from the current directory simply by default. In real life, if we were making a game that was going to install on someone's computer, we would probably put this avatar icon or graphic in like /usr/share/, you know, the name of our game, but we're not going to do that for now to keep it simple. And the one thing that we need to do in addition to having just spawned our player is we're going to add our player to the all sprites list. And that in order to do that, you simply invoke all_sprites_list.addParentPlayer(). And it's called player because that's what our variable is called, right? Player equals avatar parent quote penguin.png /. So we've just added our player, our main player, to the all sprites list. So I think that's pretty clear. The other thing that we'll need to do for our game is spawn food so that in our game, our player has something to interact with. And the thing that we're going to spawn for our player to interact with will be some kind of food item that a penguin might like. You can use whatever you want. And of course, the great place for free graphics for this little exercise would be openclipart.org. If you go there, you will probably be able to find a penguin. That's where I found mine, or whatever character you want your main player to be. So the next code block will be for I, and that's the word for, F-O-R, for I in range, paren 10, /:. You could do more than 10, you could do fewer than 10, but this should look familiar to you already, because in our dice games, we did this kind of thing all the time, right? We did for loops and things like that. So for I in range, paren 10, paren, that's saying 10 times we want to do the following functions. And the following things that we want to do need, of course, one level of indentation, so tab, and we'll call it collectible equals avatar paren quote food.png /. And you should see right away what we're doing there. We're creating a variable called collectible, and we're setting it to our own class called avatar. And of course, the thing that we need to give avatar every time we invoke it is a file name of a graphic. And so we'll give it food.png, which, you know, could be anything. It could be hamburgers, it could be fish, it could be carrots, whatever penguins like, I don't know. The next line will be collectible.rect.x equals random.randrange /window_width /. And I'll bet, even without knowing a whole lot of Python yet, you can probably guess what that line is doing. We're saying, okay, we know that we have a collectible object now, because we've just spawned one. So let's take that collectible object, and let's append .rect.x to it, which, if you look in your Pygame documentation, you'll find out that that's how we can set the position location of our sprite on screen. So we'll set the x-axis of its rectangle to be equal to the built-in Python function of random, but not just random, completely random. We want it to be random within a certain range. So the way that you do that in Python is random.randrange, and then you have to give it the upper limit, you know, of what its range should be. So we'll say paren window_width, which I think we set to 960. So essentially it's going to give us a random number from 0 to 960, and it's going to set that number, or it's going to set the x position of our graphic to some number along, you know, from 0 to 960. And we'll do the same thing with the y position, except obviously instead of width we'll use height. So it's collectible.rect.y equals random.randrange /window_height /. So once again, you see that using that variable comes in handy, because we never said, you know, we never have to set the number 960, we can just say window_width. And that way, when we re-release this game for high def, or for, you know, 2K TVs or something, we can just go into our variable block where we said window_width equals 960 and change that to like 2048 or whatever. And then it would ripple through every other time that we used window width, whether it's when we were creating our game world, or whether we were setting the position of our food variables, and so on. So that's a really, really good example of why you should use variables rather than going in and plugging in numbers and then going back through and with sed and just doing a replace 960 with 2048, because what if you used 960 somewhere else? Then you wouldn't want it to be used maybe, you know, here. So yeah, it's good. Okay, and then we're going to do of course, we're going to add the food that we have just spawned to the food list, right? So we'll say food underscore list dot add paren collectible close paren. And then we will also add it to the all sprites list. So all underscore sprites underscore list dot add paren collectible close paren. And you'll see what we do with these groups in a little while, but it's kind of important to track these things. And that's a purely a game mechanic. Also, obviously, you're not really going to have that sort of thing in every program you ever write, but it's good to get used to kind of managing assets. Okay, so the next block of stuff that we're going to do is really big and long, but it's actually super simple. A little bit verbose at the beginning, but it's pretty simple. And this isn't the way that you'll always do controls in Pygame, but it's, again, just kind of good logic exercise and good to see how there's very rarely one way of doing anything, you know? It's not always that simple. And for this, we're going to do a sort of a simple keyboard control mechanism. So the way we'll do it is we'll create a variable called moveDown, and we'll set that equal to true. We'll make a new variable called moveUp, and we'll set that to true. And then moveLeft equals true, and moveRight equals true. So all move variables are set to true. And then we'll say move underscore speed equals 10. Okay, so that's just the setup. So now we're going to start a loop, and we're going to call it main, and we're going to call it, we're going to set that to true. And you may remember, I think we might have done this before, maybe not. You'll see though. So main equals true, and then the next line will be while space main equal true colon. So this is just setting up, this is a typical kind of loop setup in Python, where you say, okay, the next block of code is going to be called main, and we're going to set it to true, and then while main is true, which means now, always, do these certain things. And the reason that we have to do it that way, obviously, is because in a video game, or any graphical application really, you don't want it to launch something and then quit, right? You want it to launch something and then keep going. You want it to be forever looping and listening for signals, whether it's a button click or a key press or a mouse click or whatever. That's what GUI applications really do. They launch and then they enter this really, what's that famous word? Infinite loop of just waiting for input from the player or the user. Okay, so while main is true, we're going to do one tab for event in pygame.event.get paren paren colon. So this is the way that you get events in Pygame. And an event is any number of things that Pygame is programmed to see as an event. And in this case, we're really interested in the key presses. And so there's a special kind of event for a key press. But first we'll knock out almost a guaranteed event at some point is going to be the quit event. So we'll say tab if event.type equals pygame.quit colon tab, that's three tabs because now we're in this little if loop, pygame.quit paren paren semicolon sys.exit paren paren, and then the next line tab main equals false. So this is basically every possible way that anyone could ever want to quit our game, we're making sure that that happens. So we're saying if the event type is pygame.quit event. Now Pygame automatically, it can detect a bunch of different quit signals. Like if I press the close button on the window, Pygame sees that and it says, oh, that was a quit event. Okay, I'll quit now. Or when you, I don't know, right click on the window border and choose close, or you hit meta W if you're on my computer. All of those things are control Q, maybe, I don't know. All of those things are interpreted as quit events by Pygame. So if we receive that kind of signal, then we're going to invoke one of three different ways of closing the application. One is the Pygame way. That's pygame.quit paren paren. Now we do a semicolon so that if that fails, then a sys.exit paren paren will work. And a sys.exit paren paren, from what I've heard, is is a nice way to make sure that on other platforms you're still quitting. Like if pygame.quit doesn't get that window to close, sometimes on other platforms sys.exit will. Now if that doesn't work, so if both of those failed, then we also invoke main equals false. And of course we've only set this loop to continue for as long as main is true, right? So setting it to main equals false, the next iteration through that loop, the computer should see that main is no longer true, that it is now false, and it should quit the game. Okay? So that's a lot of quitting for one quit signal, but that's to make sure that on every platform anyone runs this on, no matter whether it's Linux or any other OS, it receives that quit signal, and it quits. Because it's really annoying when a program won't quit. I mean, people generally interpret that as a crash, essentially. Okay, so we're out of that loop, so we're only doing two tabs now. So tab, if event.type equals key down, and that's all capitals, key down, colon. So this is a key down event, and we'll do tab, if event.key equals k underscore left, or event.key equals ord paren quote a quote close paren colon. Okay, so the key down obviously is when you're pressing the key down. Not the down arrow, understand, just when you are depressing a key, when you press down on it. If that's the kind of event that we're receiving, now we're going to start checking to see what key was pressed. So if the event key was the key, the k left, which is Pygame's shorthand for a left arrow, or the event key is equal to A, which is any gamer would know that that is left, then we're going to move right, we're going to set that to false, and we're going to set move left to true. And then the next block we'll do an if event.key equals k right, or event key equals ord d as in delta, then we'll set the move left to false and the move right to true. So A is going to move us left, D is going to move us right, or the left arrow key will move us left, and the right will move us right. So you can kind of get the idea. So that, you know, K underscore up and K underscore down, all of that's basically the same code after one another within this key down if loop. And again, if you want to see all that, you can see it on the webpage. So the next loop that we would do, again, so just two tabs, would be if space event.type equals key up, colon. So this is when you take your finger off the key. The key is now coming upward, and again, you have to check and see what key is being pressed. So again, just to make sure, I do a check for the Q key. So if event.key equals ord paren quote Q quote paren colon, then I do a pygame.quit and a sysexit there as well. And I should have probably do a main false, but I didn't. But you could. You could do that there. And then, of course, you just do the normal stuff. If event key equals k left or a, then move left is false. If event key is k right or event key equals ord d as in delta, then you do a move right is false. So notice that you're not setting anything to true here. You're just setting things to false because now they've lifted their finger off the key. Nothing needs to be true. It's just the direction that was set to true needs to now be false so that they're no longer moving up. Of course, just because we've set these things to true and to false doesn't actually mean that Pygame is doing anything. It just means that variables have been flipped, you know, the bits have been flipped. So we do actually need to write the motion block, the thing that moves the sprite around the screen. And that's not hard either. It's another set of if loops. And they only get one tab because they're in the main loop, but they're not in the event loop. So we just do one tab. Tab if space move down and player.rect.bottom is less than the window underscore height, colon, tab player.rect.top plus or equal move underscore speed. Again, this is basically the same thing four times, so I'm going to explain it once, and then you can do it four times to equal or to be what you would want. So we're saying if move down, meaning in Python, that means if it's true. So if move down is false, then that would not satisfy the if move down statement. But if move down is true, then that passes. So if move down and player.rect.bottom is less than the window height. So that obviously means that if I'm pressing a down key, whether it's the down arrow or the S key on my keyboard, then and the bottom of my sprite is less than the value of the window height, meaning I'm not off screen, then we're going to set the player.rect.top value. We're going to add to the top value the move speed, which is 10. So we're basically taking the bounding box, and we're adding 10 to wherever the bounding box is, which would, of course, make it move down the screen, right? Because the value starts at 0 at the top and goes down to, what, 720? So we're going to move that. We're going to keep adding 10 until the bottom of that rectangle, of that bounding box, hits the bottom. If it hits 720, then we will no longer do that. He'll just sit there. I can press down as much as I want. He won't go off screen. So the same principle applies to all of the other movement directions. So if move up and player.rect.top is greater than 0, then player.rect.top minus equal move underscore speed. So again, we are going to minus 10 from the top bounding box value. Unless it becomes, if it hits 0, then we don't do that anymore, because we've set player.rect.top to only, this will only work if it's greater than 0. So that makes sense. Okay, and then if move left and player.rect.left is greater than 0, then of course we take the value of player.rect.left and we minus the move speed, minus equal move speed. And if move right and player.rect.right is less than the window width, then player.rect.right plus equal move underscore speed. So this is moving the sprite around the screen, and it is using the known limits of the screen, the hard-coded 0, because that's always a limit in Pygame, that's the standard, and then we use our variable window width and window height to make sure that we're not going off the screen. And you could give yourself a little bit of leeway, right? You could say if it's less than window height plus 10, you know, if you wanted to give your sprite the ability to kind of nudge off screen a little bit, but that's, why bother? Okay, so now we're going to see if the player spawn has collided with anything. This is super simple collision detection. Again, there are much better ways to do this, but we're nearing the end of both this program and the show. Let's just keep it simple. So we'll see if the player spawn has collided. So we'll do a tab, because we're still in this main loop, right? In this while main equals equals true. So everything we're doing right now gets at least one tab. So this is one tab, and it's food underscore hit underscore list equals pygame.sprite.sprite collide paren player comma food underscore list comma true close paren. Okay, so in order to even begin to understand that, it's really as simple as going over to the documentation for Pygame and reading up on the collision stuff. And that's not really that hard to do. You just have to kind of read it and understand it, and then you can try it out. But I'm going to explain it to you anyway. So, sprite.spriteCollide, it takes three arguments, which you'll see in the documentation. So it takes the name of one constant sprite, which is the player, who never disappears, and the name of another sprite, or a sprite group, and the Boolean condition true. And that's really all there is to, simple collision detection in Pygame. It's just telling it, hey, Pygame, would you please check to see if this sprite and anything in this other sprite group have happened to collide, and if so, let me know. And that's all you have to do. And then, of course, so Pygame goes off and sort of calculates that for you, but then you need to check the list of collisions. And the way that you do that is you do again, tab, because we're still in the main loop, and it's for instance, spawn in food underscore hit underscore list colon tab tab score plus equal 1, and then the next line tab tab print paren score paren. And there you go. So that is literally all you need to do to figure out if there's collision between the player sprite and anything that is a member of the food underscore list group. And if there is a collision, then you're going to check for it, and you're going to increment your score by 1 for every time that they collide. The next thing that you can do is fill your world with a color, so window underscore area dot fill paren black close paren. And then, of course, you need to spawn your sprites. So the way that you do that would be all underscore sprites underscore list dot draw paren window underscore area close paren. So once again, you see the variables coming in handy here, because we don't have to tell it the window, how to get the window area. It's just a variable that we've already created. We've said it's a window underscore area is our game world, and so take all the sprites list, everything in the sprites list, which is all the sprites that we have, and draw them into that space. And then since we're in this main loop, of course the computer's going through this every tick, so we'll do the clock or tab clock.tickParentFPSParent. And this advances the clock by whatever value our FPS is set to. And you can try taking some of these things out of the loop if you comment something out and see what happens. Some of them, especially the all sprites list draw. No, not that one, sorry. The window area. The window area fill. That one and the clock tick is kind of interesting, I think. You might find that interesting to move around. And then you've also got to do a very important thing, and this one's really important and really interesting to move around your code. It's tab pygame.display.flip parent. Now what flip does is it refreshes essentially what we've drawn. So we've just drawn all of our sprites on screen, and now we're telling it, okay, flip the display. So basically refresh. If you move that around, you'll get really interesting results while you're playing your game. Usually not good ones. And that's it. That is your game. If you fire that up, as long as you've got the graphics in the same folder, you'll need a graphic for your hero and a graphic for your food. As long as they're in the same directory as your game code itself, it should spawn a window, and you should be able to move your player around, gather food, and you'll see in the terminal from which you've launched your game, you'll actually see your score increment as you collect food. And that's all you need to do. It's really kind of easy in a sort of, it only took us an hour to do it way. But hopefully some of that makes sense to you, and the logic of it starts to make sense. And I've always felt that the logic of programming is a little bit inverse from how you might think that it needs to be done, and it definitely tends for me to be inverse of how I would script it. And that's an important thing to remember, because a lot of times we might think, okay, well, the first thing we need to do is draw our sprites on the screen, but you notice that we didn't actually draw the sprites really on the screen until, like, the last five lines, and even that is something that we do in a loop. So it's a little bit logically seems a little bit backwards, but once you get a feel for it, you realize it's not so much backwards as it is inside out, and because it's inside out, it gives you a lot of flexibility of how you have things occur within an already running process. That's why it's inside out, because something's running, and then things are happening. That's how I think of it anyway. So hopefully that is informative. We will do more soon. I don't know how much of the big game project we'll be able to do from the website, simply because me sitting here reading line after line of Python code does tend to get a little bit abstract and a little bit boring, so we may skip around quite a bit from here, but I did want to cover just a basic thing in Pygame. But there are some things in PyCute that I think are really, really cool, and some things that you can do really in like 10 or 12 lines of code that are really kind of cool and demonstrate a lot of different logical principles and constructs that are useful to get a handle on. So we're going to do that next time, probably, and see where that gets us. Thank you very much for listening to my show. I certainly appreciate your listenership, and thanks for coming back after I moved away and was off air for such a long time, and I'll talk to you next week. No, I won't. I'll talk to you in 2 weeks. Thanks. That's it for this week's episode. Thank you very much for listening. My name is Klaatu. You can reach me via email at klaatu@member.fsf.org. You can find me online at gnuworldorder.info or slackermedia.info. Thank you very much for listening, and I'll talk to you next time.
paz.